You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Inspiration comes from everywhere, and it can come at any time. Nature is hopefully all around us, and it really does have a calming effect. Or it can, I suppose, not if you're being chased by a lion or something. But the beauty of nature, people have always wanted to bring it into the home in one way or another. Whether it's through paintings, or sculptures, or furniture, or the architecture of the house itself. This time, we're actually catching up from the medieval world to the peak of Art Nouveau and into the modern day. My name's Renee. You're listening to Detours in Archaeology. And this is part two of the new art of the ancient world. And now let's move to Portugal. Because that's where I had the inspiration to write this entire article. Hints of their maritime history were evident everywhere in their close connection with nature. Many, if not the majority of houses in Lisbon and Porto, had walls covered with tiles, and nearly all of them did in Aveiro as well. The sidewalks sometimes featured geometric patterns, while other times displayed swirling decorative designs. Many doorways were adorned with artistic elements above them, depicting nature, gods and goddesses, or just people and animals. Today, nature scenes aren't necessarily Art Nouveau, but they still reflect a connection to nature. Other artistic remnants include the house's color schemes and decorative details, which contribute to the overall aesthetic. Now, does this relate to Art Nouveau design? Aveiro was Portugal's major hub for Art Nouveau, even hosting an Art Nouveau museum, though the tiles decorated with nature scenes are common everywhere, especially those really large blue and white paintings on large pieces of ceramic, which are extremely common in train stations, museums, churches, the sides of buildings, anywhere. But as a city, Aveiro is called the Venice of Portugal because of its canals running through some of the streets. The main street features the canal stretching all the way to the ocean, and it's truly stunning there. In Portugal, they call Art Nouveau, or their particular style of Art Nouveau, Arte Nova, because it's the name in Portuguese instead of French. Many houses built in this style feature swirling buttresses and intricately carved doorways, but really only the wealthy could ever afford such homes. Their furniture is designed to resemble naturally grown vegetation. That's simply the style. And of course, the wealthiest of the wealthy were the royalty living in palaces. The palaces are truly where the entire style originates. The Pena Palace and the Blink Palace in Sintra are absolutely stunning. One has the most magnificent crown molding, with the most intricate work throughout every aspect of their architecture. And there are vast gardens that now are designated as national gardens, and even a national park. You do have to pay for entry, but believe me, it's worth it. You don't need a guide, it's fine. Starting with the Sintra palaces, the Quinta de Regueira. Our exploration began with the Quinta de Regueira and its gardens. The palace and gardens were constructed in the late 19th to early 20th century, the perfect time to have built an Art Nouveau-inspired Eden. While large gardens are common for palaces, the innovative design of these was especially impressive. The pathway to the palace, outside of the gate, was meant to symbolize a journey towards enlightenment, in a Christian sense. The sidewalks leading to the gates had stars engraved on the stones, guiding visitors like a trail of light. The gardens themselves were inspired by Dante's Inferno, featuring layers of the underworld, or hell, notably the well's staircase descending into the natural cave system. Visitors are typically directed to start there, as tours will often lead you down first, though it's not best to resist the flow or spend too long taking pictures, I guess you could possibly go the other way. You might get yelled at, though. After the staircase, the trail opens into a pitch-black section. Rather, it would be if there wasn't artificial lights like put on the walls. Until you reach a lagoon and a waterfall with so many flowers, creating a floral paradise. The guide then allowed us to explore the gardens freely, wandering among the statues, outbuildings, shrines, and multiple palaces on the grounds. There was no strict itinerary. We only had like an hour, but if you went by yourself, you could obviously spend all day. You can roam around the mountain, observing the varied mini biomes created artificially a century ago. The decor features natural and maritime motifs with temple shrines, lattice works, and ceramics. Though not strictly Art Nouveau, the design embodies its core principle, integrating the natural world into human spaces. Maritime elements that incorporate shells, coral, and fish motifs are also extremely common, alongside stone carvings made to resemble ropes, rigging, and ship planks. Quinta de Regalia in Sintra is like a real-life fairy tale, blending architecture, landscape design, and mystical symbols. Its buildings and gardens mix above-ground, almost paradise-like elements with hidden underground darker motifs, creating a symbolic map of initiation, myths, and spiritual origins. This combination shows how the architecture, garden layout, and underground features work together to tell a spiritual story. It also connects Regalia to larger ideas about symbolic landscapes, hermetic and medieval modern esotericism, and traditional Portuguese scenery. It's all in a huge mountain. It's gorgeous! As conceptual framework, the architecture has a symbolic language. The Quinta's design revolves around two central themes, epigea, representing everything above ground, and hypogea, encompassing everything underground. These elements together narrate a journey through paradise and the underworld, akin to an initiation pilgrimage. Recent research on Higuerilla's symbolic layout highlights this idea, particularly in relation to the architect Manini's architectural style. The study reveals how Luigi Manini integrated mythological, epic, Templar, and alchemist symbols into the building's forms, materials, and pathways. It's crucial to understand that the architecture doesn't stand alone. It interacts seamlessly with the gardens and underground tunnels to form a cohesive symbolic experience. The architecture at Higuerilla is like a puzzle of symbols, shapes, and locations. The rugged granite architecture of Sintra's Serra de Sintra is cleverly used to create underground spaces like grottos and tunnels that both feel infernal and mystical, while the features above ground serve as a gateway to heavenly or paradise-like views. It's a kind of crossroads of symbols where the architecture itself becomes a visual language packed with hidden meanings, myths, and spiritual rituals. People tend to agree that Manini's work here taps into a broader European tradition where gardens and landscapes are seen as extensions of architecture, places that shape how we experience and interpret space. The mix of above and below ground levels tells a story of wandering through archetypal spaces, mimicking the journeys found in esoteric and hermetic traditions, almost as if guiding you along an initiatory path. The garden at Quinta de Higuerilla feels like a world of signs, water features, grottos, knot patterns, winding paths, and citrus groves that together create kind of a cosmology that you can walk through. This makes it a key example of a landscape where the art of garden design and deep symbolic meanings come together, forming what's called a symbolic or courtly garden, but with the mystical twist that I already talked about. Broadly speaking, Portuguese garden tradition often links to historic gardens like Quintas de Recreio or recreational estates with stories of power, culture, and symbolism, where the architecture and the garden are deeply connected, serving as areas for storytelling and rituals, not just pretty scenery. The iconography of Higareya also ties into Europe's long history of hermetic gardens, where hermitages, grottos, and allegorical elements are used to hide esoteric knowledge through natural and structural design. The network of grottos and symbolic paths echo these traditions, with the mythological and alchemical symbols serving as a secret language to share knowledge that is not meant for everyone. This links Higareya to a broader European conversation about hermetic garden art and the initiatory landscapes. One of the coolest things about Quinta de Higareya is what's underground. Besides the palace and the gardens, there's this whole hidden world that you don't see at first glance. The initiation well, with the series of tunnels that go down, along with the caverns and grotto rooms that are all connected into one looping route. It's supposed to be kind of like Dante's trip into hell and purgatory, being an alchemical and spiritual transformation pathway. This underground part works in tandem with the temple's terraces and above-ground viewpoints, creating a dual experience that keeps shifting between heavenly and hellish meanings. Scholars often see the underground areas and surrounding geology as part of the spiritual journey that's sometimes called a true mundi peregrinatio, a real-world pilgrimage that reflects the sacred geometric patterns and ritual initiations from late medieval and early modern hermetic traditions. Since the design is so closely connected to the rock, the earth almost becomes part of the scene. The careful combination of geometry and underground spaces turns the landscape into a stage where natural elements and human-made structures blend together. Some researchers even emphasize the importance of the site's granite geology, suggesting that the tunnels and chambers were carefully built within the natural rock formations. The close link between the physical material and the symbolic meaning supports the idea that Higareya's underground architecture intentionally combines these geologic features with esoteric themes, one of the reasons it's considered so unique. And remember, we could actually do this relatively quickly at the time, because it was the late 19th and early 20th centuries. We had the technology. Quinta de Higareya is part of Sintra's UNESCO World Heritage Site, a place renowned for its unique combination of architecture, gardens, and rugged landscapes that all harmonize. Within this setting, Higareya stands out as something special. It is part of the long-standing tradition of estates situated between the misty granite hills and striking architecture. People often view Sintra as a layered canvas of grand gardens and historic buildings, and Higareya balances dramatic natural scenery with architecture rich in symbolism, which is characteristic of Sintra, yet has its own unique character. The entire Sintra area is known for its rich mixture of imaginative buildings and architecture that highlight the connection between landscape, geology, and symbolic themes. Hillside palaces, winding paths, and water features are often designed to tell stories about nature, history, and identity. Higareya takes this concept even further by emphasizing the initiatory aspect, that the whole estate can be viewed as a narrative of climbing and descending, life and death. We're moving up and down stairs, exploring grottos, and passing through light and darkness are intended to reflect spiritual and mystical transformation. The Palacio de Higareya sits at the heart of Manini's symbolic design for the estate. It acts as a main anchor both above and below ground. It's built in the early 20th century, and it wasn't meant to just be a residence, but a central element of the larger landscape that ties together the terraces, grottos, tunnels, and other features into a unified piece. In this sense, the palace is part of a carefully planned story about movement, symbolism, and experience across the entire property. The Tour de Higareya, so the tower, and all the grotto areas really deepen the symbolic feel of the estate by adding vertical and underground elements. The tower stands out as a visual and symbolic focal point, providing a counterpoint to the wells and the underground passages below. Plus, spots like the Gruta do Labirinto, or Labyrinth Cave, and other grottos are seen as important parts of the underground network that play with ideas of going down and coming back up. These spaces were probably built around the same time as the palace and the tower, showing that they were all part of a coordinated design. In this underground and landscape system, spots like the Pozio Iniciatico, the Gruta de Leda, and the connected grotto network works together with the Teresa dos Mundos Celestes and the Porta dos Guajiois to lead visitors down a symbolic path. The initiation well, in particular, stands out as a key part of this underground access, giving visitors a sense of exploring the estate's hidden layers and emphasizing the idea of an initiatory journey. The terraces, portals, and thresholds serve as scenic pauses and transitions, acting like symbolic crossroads that guide both your physical movement and your experience as you wander through the thoughtfully crafted layout. Most scholars say that Quinta de Herrera was influenced by Art Nouveau, but with some important caveats. They usually focus on Luigi Manini and how he designed the estate to link the buildings above ground with the underground tunnels and grottos through layers of symbolism. Several researchers place Herrera with the bigger European context of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, when Art Nouveau was a major trend in architecture and decoration. They point out stylistic connections in the forms, materials, and modernist influences seen in Portugal at the time. Still, they stress that Herrera is not straightforward or pure Art Nouveau building. Instead, it's an eclectic mix loaded with the symbolism and drawing on neoclassical, romantic, and hermetic-inspired styles. Overall, the scholarship agrees that the core of the site is its esoteric, symbolic, heavy program, with Art Nouveau acting as just one part of a broader stylistic blend rather than the main defining style. The estate does fit into the wider world of turn-of-the-century architecture, when Art Nouveau was fashionable, but its main focus was the esoteric narrative, not serving as a pure Art Nouveau showpiece. Several authors place Herrera within the broader Art Nouveau or Liberty scene without calling it a perfect example. Instead, they connect it to the Hermetic Gardens, initiatory landscapes, and the spread of steel Liberty across Europe, which included Italy and Portugal. This suggests that while Art Nouveau forms and motifs do appear in Herrera's decoration and period styling, they are always woven into a wider, more eclectic symbolism. The Portuguese context backs this up. When you look at historic gardens and landscape design in Portugal, Herrera fits into a longer tradition that picks up Art Nouveau elements but also keeps its own distinctive features, symbolic plants, winding grotto paths, and a layout that feels like the ritual journey. Underlying Manini's approach, especially the dual layout, scholars often look at the one layer of above ground and below, and the old alchemical idea of as above, so below, and that idea that an underground network holds the core symbolic meaning of that site. Scholars who study Iberian and European Art Nouveau more broadly show how the movement spread in Portugal, especially in decoration, tiles, and modern style designs. Because of all of this, there is still an ongoing debate of how much weight to give Art Nouveau compared to Herrera's hermetic symbolism. Many scholars point out that the site mixes hermetic, Templar, mythic, and alchemical symbols, which can visually overlap with Art Nouveau's flowing lines and natural motifs, and still, the general consensus is that Art Nouveau is just one influence. Moving to other sites now, I know you're thinking, finally! Pena National Palace in Sintra showcases a romantic national style that mixes maritime and natural symbols. With a dramatic hillside position and bold theatrical shapes, Its eclectic mix of neo-medieval, romantic, and exotic elements fits in with Sintra's broader tradition of symbolic landscapes, grottos, and dramatic terrain. Penna is more deeply rooted in romantic national ideas, with a strong mountain-by-the-sea atmosphere and a love for architecture that blends nature-inspired fantasy. Penna's history and design can help clarify this context. It began as a medieval chapel and later became a Hieronymite monastery. Back in the 16th century, so 1500s, Manuel I of Portugal promised to rebuild something and made good on that promise by donating it to the Order of St. Jerome. He initially had a wooden convent built, which was later replaced with a stone one that could house 18 monks. And if you didn't know, the 1500s was after the Reconquista in the late 1500s. So the Islamic religion had been pushed out of Portugal by this point, usurped once again by Christian people. But fast forwarding to the 18th century, a lightning strike damaged part of the tower, chapel, and sacristy. Things got worse after the big 1755 earthquake, which basically left the convent in ruins. The only thing that stayed pretty much untouched was the main altar in the chapel, with its beautiful marble and alabaster altarpiece, which is believed to have been made by Nicolau de Chantereen, a famous French sculptor and architect. In the 19th century, Ferdinand II and Baron von Eswege transformed it into a romantic place, setting it within the landscaped Parc de Penne. Architecturally, the site mixes styles such as Neo-Madeleine, Neo-Gothic, Neo-Islamic, and Neo-Renaissance. Symbolically, it is full of maritime and natural motifs, twisting stone ropes, shells, corals, and the famous Triton Gate, all celebrating Portugal's age of discovery and the surrounding landscape. The way that Penna combines rock formations, organic domes, vegetal stucco, and interior forest imagery offers a clear example of how Portuguese architecture and nature can blend into a unified whole. Beyond Penna, there are other Portuguese palaces and garden complexes like the Palacio Nacional de Sintra, like the gardens at Queluz, Palacio Fronteira, and Quinta de Belas, which all use water, grotto motifs, dramatic locations, and nature-inspired decoration in overlapping ways. The sites point to a broader Portuguese tradition of blending landscape with architecture to create scenic, often maritime-themed environments. For example, Queluz's 18th century water systems and garden designs demonstrate how controlled water and landscape can tell stories. Fonteria's fountains and carefully framed views, along with Quinta de Belas's cascade grotto and faux ruin motifs, highlight earlier Portuguese experiments with garden architecture that mix natural-looking rockwork, water features, and scenic drama. Taken together, these examples suggest that Portuguese palaces and gardens often worked as a unified symbolic system, using both architecture and landscape to tell layered stories. They blend the above-ground and underground spaces, draw on maritime and natural motifs, and connect to a long garden heritage, rather than simply fitting into a single style label like Art Nouveau. In Portugal, Art Nouveau is mainly seen in the cities of Aveiro, Caldas de Rainha, and Porto, mostly found in private homes and in shops, especially ones that were converted from private homes owned by wealthy folks who got rich through business and industry, or, you know, royalty. In Aveiro, there are 28 notable buildings, statues, and monuments that are celebrated as part of the Art Nouveau city. The Museo Arte Nova is located inside the major Pessoa house built between 1907 and 1909, designed by the architects Francisco Augusto da Silva Roca and Ernesto Corondi, two very well-known designers of that era. Probably the most influential Art Nouveau artist in the area was Francisco Augusto da Silva Roca. Even though he didn't have formal architectural training, he designed buildings in Oviedo and other Portuguese cities. At the museum, they give out a pamphlet map that explains how between 1904 and 1920, Oviedo's development was driven by the wealthy, and that even today, the streets are decorated with buildings and facades covered in glazed tiles, showcasing the Art Nouveau style with organic and floral motifs, an interpretation of that artistic movement. The local Art Nouveau style, called Arte Nova, was big in Oviedo, Portugal, and its main vibe was about showcasing wealth. People used fancy facades to flaunt their riches while keeping the interiors more traditional, even though they still had the furniture and some artistic designs that still fit in Art Nouveau. A key feature of Arte Nova was the use of local tiles decorated with those signature Arte Nova patterns. What I think is really cool is how most buildings all over Portugal are covered in these colorful tiles. It's not just for looks, they're also really practical. Since materials like stone and wood tend to degrade from salt air, layering tiles helps to protect the buildings. Plus, if tiles get worn down, you can easily replace them without tearing down a whole wall, which ends up saving time and money. Oviedo is really where Art Nouveau movement is celebrated in Portugal. Walking or taking a boat through the downtown area really gives you a good sense of why it's called Portugal's Little Venice. There's a wide, branching canal, and what really gives it that Venice feel are the vibrant colors, artistic details, and the overall atmosphere. It's another spot in Portugal where nature and the ocean are really brought right into the city, even if it's only really kind of in that downtown area. Most of the buildings are clustered around the main road, Rua João Mendoza, and near the central canal of the Ria. Just across from the Arte Nova Museum, or Museu Arte Nova, although it took a while for Arte Nova to take off in Portugal because of slow industrial growth, it eventually blossomed in cities like Porto and Oviedo, which have a lot of buildings inspired by European, especially French, styles. In Caldas da Rainha, they started making ceramic objects inspired by natural motifs typical of Art Nouveau. Think lettuce or cabbage-shaped plants, pumpkin-shaped tureens, or even fish-shaped planters. These popular items are actually still made today. There are other examples of Art Nouveau around Portugal too. In Lisbon, there's the Dr. Anastasio Gonçalves Museum residence built by Manuel Joaquim Norte Jr. in 1901 to 1905. And in Porto, you can check out the Café Majestic by João Queiroz in 1921. And Livraria Lelo, the Lelo bookstore by Xavier Esteves in 1906. But I'm focused on the ones that I chose in this episode because I was actually there and saw and was able to take pictures of everything. And it was amazing. Going back to the roots. Even though several countries continued to call their style Art Nouveau, the British really claimed it as their own, even though it was French. They pointed to William Morris's beautiful floral designs and the arts and crafts movement that his students started as the roots of everything. Some of the earliest examples of this style include the Red House, with interiors designed by Morris and architecture by Philip Webb in 1859, and the extravagant Peacock Room by James Abbott McNeill Whistler. The movement also drew inspiration from Pre-Raphaelite painters such as Dante Gabriel Rossetti and Edward Burne Jones. British graphic artists of the 1880s also played a huge role, with names such as Selwyn Image, Haywood Sumner, Walter Crane, Alfred Gilbert, and especially Aubrey Beardsley influencing the look. In fact, Arthur McMurdo's chair is often seen as a precursor to what would become the Art Nouveau design. Going through the chronology, as I touched on in part one, Art Nouveau emerged in a European environment increasingly influenced by Japanese art, the arts and crafts movement, botanical science, and classic traditions, rejecting historicism in favor of natural forms accessible to all before spreading internationally and then waning around World War I. Though it persisted longer in some regions, such as Ukraine, where it persisted through 1941. Ukraine was a special case in which rapid urban growth and industrial construction affected modernist architecture, leading to more asymmetrical designs, varied facades, and diverse window styles. Because their particular Art Nouveau was quite individualistic, I'll continue to mention them separately in future subject matters. The 1889 Paris World's Fair really kicked off the development of the artistic movement, showcasing engineers' innovative use of materials like glass, iron, and steel. It was a game changer that pushed traditionally trained architects to think outside the box about space, light, and color. Art Nouveau, in particular, embraced the realities of modern industrial society by using industrial materials, mass production, and standardization. The style's architecture often featured glass and iron, and it introduced new building types like exhibition halls and department stores, setting important precedents. Art Nouveau emerged as a distinct movement in the early 1890s, with December 1895 marking a significant movement where Samuel Bing opened his modern decoration store, L'Art Nouveau, in Paris. The store's inaugural exhibition featured works by Brangwyn, Benson, Van de Velde, Vuillard, Besnard, Dennis, Tiffany, Bonnard, Ebels, and Ranson, creating a commercial and cultural hub for the emerging style. While these elements had not yet coalesced into a unified aesthetic, they would soon under the name Art Nouveau. The movement's openness to new materials and techniques demonstrated its forward-looking nature. Then, the 1900 Paris World Exhibition continued to be a key venue for showcasing the main trends in European art, while horticultural exhibitions in Western Europe, especially Belgium, not only drew big crowds, but also boosted local economies and influenced commercial interests. The movement's theoretical foundations were first articulated in the architecture in France and Belgium at the end of the 19th century, which jolted traditionally trained architects like Victor Horta in Brussels to explore wholly new approaches to space, light, and color. Architect and theorist Franz Jordan articulated the movement's core principle in 1889, "Un dépôt soit nouveau, les formes nouvelles." New forms for new needs. Art Nouveau drew upon multiple converging influences. As I previously talked about, Japanese art provided crucial inspiration for organic lines, asymmetry, and non-Western spatial concepts, with Samuel Bing's activities in the 1870s to 1890s facilitating this cross-cultural exchange. The arts and crafts movement promoted democratic ideals in the aim of creating art accessible to all classes, while botanical research and illustration provided specific natural forms that influence artistic motifs. Classic literature and iconography also shaped the movement, though artists reinterpreted these themes rather than copying historic forms. The style emerged in response to rapid industrialization and urbanization that separated people from nature, yet simultaneously embraced industrial materials and processes. Core principles included rejecting historicism in favor of forms inspired by nature that everyone could understand, embodying the conviction of new forms for new needs, and achieving democratic art accessible to all, even if they were mainly put on rich people's houses. They were put on the outside, people could still see them as they passed. The movement spanned from the late 19th century to the early 20th century, with some sources placing its peak influence between 1895 and 1905. Art Nouveau waned as the decade progressed, done in by conservative forces and mounting national tensions as war clouds gathered. Sensibilities retreated to historical certainties amid increasingly unsettled times. In Ukraine, Art Nouveau architecture developed through three distinct stages, 1903 to 1917, 1920 to 1930, and 1934 to 1941, with approximately 40 years of development before facing suppression during the totalitarian system. Art Nouveau originated in France and Belgium, with Paris serving as the particularly important center. From these origins, the movement spread rapidly across Europe and North America, adapting to each country and city to which it was brought. This international diffusion resulted in numerous regional variations, giving each a different name. In Scotland, it was known as the Glasgow style. In Italy, Stile Liberty. In Austria, Secession Stil, or Succession style. And in Barcelona, as Modernisme. Key centers of this development included Paris, Brussels, New York, and Moscow. In Ukraine, major hubs emerged in Poltava, Lviv, Kharkiv, and Kyiv, where the style was represented by five main architectural approaches: modernist, folkloric, rationalist, neo-baroque, and Vienna Secession. Western Ukraine particularly showed the influence of Vienna Secession, where the style was known as Secession, while central, southern, and eastern Ukraine developed a national style called Ukraine Modernism, which emerged in Poltava. Belgium's Brussels is a pretty big deal in the Art Nouveau scene, with famous architects like Victor Horta and Henry van de Velde calling it home. The city is dotted with UNESCO World Heritage Sites, including the Tassel House and Solvay House, both showcasing the style's signature fluid lines, which some even joked looking like Tallinn style or eel style. Over in France, the term Art Nouveau actually started from Siegfried Bing's gallery, which I talked about, the Maison de l'Art Nouveau, with Paris gaining fame for Hector Guimard's iconic metro entrances. The Nancy School played a key role too, led by Emile Gallet and Louis Majorelle, focusing on organic-looking furniture and glassware. Germany's Jugendstil, or youth style, got its name from the magazine Jugend and is known for its sharper edges and distinctive typography, with notable figures like Peter Brenz and August Endel. Austria's Vienna Secession, founded in 1897, was all about breaking away from traditional historicism, often featuring geometric lines instead of the flowing whiplash curve seen elsewhere. With artists like Gustav Klimt and Josef Hoffmann at the forefront, Spain, especially in Barcelona, is famous for Catalan modernism, heavily influenced by Antoni Gaudi. His imaginative works like Casa Batlló and the Sagrada Familia combine organic shapes with neo-Gothic elements. Latvia's capital, Riga, boasts what some call the finest collection of Art Nouveau buildings in the world, making up about 40% of its old town, showcasing diverse styles such as eclectic, vertical, and national romantic Art Nouveau. Italy's Stile Liberty, named after the London store Liberty & Co., was popular in spa resorts and larger cities like Turin and Milan, with Carlo Bugatti standing out as a creative furniture designer within this movement. Brazil's Art Nouveau scene was largely shaped by Elisao Visconti, who brought the style into graphic arts, stamp designs, and even the interior decor of the municipal theater in Rio de Janeiro. You can see examples in architecture like the Manaus Municipal Market, which was designed by Gustav Eiffel, and the Alvarez Pintado Mansion in Sao Paulo. Moving south, both Argentina and Uruguay have preserved a lot of their Art Nouveau architecture thanks to European immigrants who settled there. In Buenos Aires, the style is evident in landmarks like the Chile Hotel, and up north in the United States, Art Nouveau is famously linked to Louis Comfort Tiffany, whose work in glassware and jewelry, called the Tiffany style, is legendary. Geographic factors influencing the spread included competitive markets, sadly imperialism, and urbanization, as well as rapid transnational exchange facilitated by industrialization. The movement's adaptation to local context is evident in how artists in Central and Eastern America use classical iconography to express new ideas of nationhood, while Ukrainian architects combined European modernism with folk architecture and ornamentation to establish their own local traditions. There are plenty of other examples of Art Nouveau in many more countries around the world, but they didn't have as much of a wider influence on the wider country and the world at large. The arts and crafts movement served as another cultural predecessor, led by figures like William Morris and John Ruskin. This movement advocated for combining art and craft to restore value of craftsmanship lost to industrialization. It aimed to create an aesthetic, harmonious total work of art to bring art to people of all classes, especially the working class. Contrary to conventional views that Art Nouveau rejected classism entirely, artists continued to draw heavily upon classic literature and the iconography of classic art. As I discussed in the Grecian section, across Europe and North America, artists looked back to the ancient world, particularly Greece, for the vitality that they sought to infuse into their creation. This classical vocabulary was often blended with Orientalist and other iconographies or preserved in its pure form. Additional influences included the Violet de Luxe, structural rationalism, innovative architectural use of iron and glass, and the poster with its energetic lines and flat fields of bold color. Botanic research and botanical illustrations also played a foundational role, with floral pots largely based on botanist discoveries. Knowledge of plant morphology opened new contexts for the iconography of European and Russian artistic heritage. Art Nouveau emerged against a backdrop of profound social transformation driven by rapid industrialization. The Industrial Revolution led to a decrease in hand craftsmanship and an increase in mass-produced, aesthetically lacking products. Great Britain's loss of industrial dominance created a more competitive international market, with newly industrializing countries searching for power through new forms of imperialism. This unavoidable rapid industrialization led to technological advances such as the Eiffel Tower, yet the majority of people opposed such technology, as shown in John Ruskin's denunciation of the machine as nothing but ugliness and despair. Yearning for what was real, the world's masses turned to nature as a basic premise. Urbanization accompanied industrialization, with movement from undeveloped areas towards commercial cities, making nature more of a rarity than ever before. In Ukraine, intensive urbanization and industrial construction led to overcrowding and the construction of multi-story buildings and a reduction in greenery. Art Nouveau embodied democratic ideals by rejecting forms from the classic language rooted in monarchical or aristocratic pasts in order to favor forms inspired by nature that everyone, regardless of class or education, could understand. The movement aimed to make art accessible to all, not just the wealthy, focusing on transforming everyday objects into works of art. This democratic ideal extended to the public street, not just the private home. Political tensions shaped the movement's trajectory. In Ukraine, the totalitarian system brought about criticism and repression that affected the development of Art Nouveau. More broadly, the national tensions mounted across Europe, conservative forces gained momentum, and contributed to the movement's decline. The turn to nature represented both a reaction against industrialization and a response to the effects of urbanization. By 1860, a truly international and exotic range of plant imagery had become available through books on botanists' travels, such as Alfred Wallace in the Malay Archipelago and J.D. Hooker in the Himalayas. These volumes, featuring magnificent illustrations of multicellular life, presenting organic life to a wide public for the first time. Direct observation of nature became possible through conservatories and hothouses in public parks of Brussels, London, Paris, Vienna, and other cities. This inevitable separation from nature due to urbanization transformed it into a major source of urban pleasure and artistic inspiration. Nature was no longer simply part of life, but it had become an object of scientific observation. Botanic research and botanical illustration served as foundational influences on Art Nouveau. Floral motifs appeared extensively in the works of Russian and foreign jewelers, ceramicists, glassblowers, and architects, with a degree of realism in these works serving as an indicator of the connection between artistic embodiment and natural prototype. The use of plants in decorative and applied art served to popularize and preserve natural heritage. The incorporation of natural forms is exemplified in Gaudí's architecture, which reflected his flawless use of nature. Ukrainian Art Nouveau similarly featured curvilinear forms, wave-like arabesques, and other creative interpretations of natural models. Czech painter and illustrator Alfons Mucha gained fame as a leading figure in Art Nouveau, especially through his posters that cleverly incorporated Japonism and Greek sculptural influences. Art Nouveau was all about revolutionizing design by rejecting the old-fashioned historical styles that had dominated for so long. Instead of copying past ideas, it looked to nature for inspiration, with flowing organic shapes, asymmetrical forms, and graceful curves that anyone could appreciate no matter their background. The movement also carried a democratic vibe, believing art should be for everyone, breaking down the barriers between high art and everyday craftsmanship. It wasn't just about fancy gallery pieces. It aimed to bring beauty into ordinary objects and public spaces, making art accessible to all and transforming homes and streets into more vibrant artistic places. The style combined practicality with aesthetics, challenging the idea that design should only serve to communicate. Art Nouveau believed that all forms of art could come together to create a unified whole, integrating architecture, interiors, painting, furniture, graphic arts, glass, ceramics into a cohesive design. When this blending extended to decorative elements like frescoes and mosaics, it enhanced the overall artistic harmony. Now you might be thinking that there seems to be an apparent tension between Art Nouveau's rejection of historical precedents and its documented use of classical influences, but it's resolved by recognizing that the movement rejected historicism as a design methodology while selectively drawing on historical content for symbolic purposes. Artists drew heavily on classic literature and the iconography of classic art does not contradict the emphasis on rejecting historicism. Rather, it shows that Art Nouveau practitioners distinguish between copying historical forms, which they would have rejected, and instead reinterpreted classical themes through modern formal vocabularies, which they would have embraced, brought things to their modern day in a way that could continue moving towards the future, instead of just being stuck in the past. The multiple influences identified weren't competing explanations, but instead converging factors. The movement synthesized these diverse influences through its core principle of seeking forms inspired by nature that could be universally understood. Each influence addressed different aspects: aesthetic vocabulary, philosophical framework, content, source, and technical means. The relationship between industrialization and Art Nouveau's focus on nature isn't just a simple reaction, it's a bit more nuanced. People often point out that the movement was against the roughness and ugliness of industrialization and had a soft spot for nature, but at the same time, it was embracing new industrial materials, mass production, and standardization. This might seem contradictory, and it is a little bit. But it actually shows that Art Nouveau was forward-thinking. It rejected the dull, soulless look of industrial stuff while still making use of the technological advances. The movement aimed to give a human touch to modern industry by merging natural shapes with industrial techniques, trying to balance technological progress with the sense of beauty and democratic ideals. But a point I really want to emphasize is that the spirit of Art Nouveau, which still continues today, is more than just paintings of nature on a wall. It's about incorporating the designs of nature into the walls, into the columns, into the furniture. It's stylistically bringing nature into the creation of a home. Anyone can hang a painting of flowers or put up a floral wallpaper, but not everyone can incorporate it into the design. This leads to the bigger question: who is this movement for? Realistically, it was those who could create the art themselves or those who could afford to buy it. The only people who got to escape the industrial reality, like all the time, would have been the wealthy, while those truly living out in nature, as it was, wouldn't have needed to bring it into their homes. They could walk out into it every day. But for the industrialized poor, neither of those options was really possible. Even while they can still see a natural aesthetic in the metro stations or different buildings and sculptures and gardens outside. So let's enjoy the nature we have now and help to make it better. If one is so lucky that they can just go out and take a hike or a nature walk among flowers and trees, we should protect it for future generations to breathe in. Let's bring a new, completely natural Art Nouveau movement back to nature itself. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Detours in Archaeology, part 2 of the new art of the ancient world. It would be amazing if anyone listening could subscribe to my podcast, to like this episode and all other episodes that they listen to, to rate and review it, and to share it with everyone you know. That is the way to get my podcast to different ears, and I really want to expand this and grow this into a whole community. Leave a comment. Head over to the website to read about and follow along with the text of this document. See all the beautiful images that I included with it and the references at the end for all my citations. I really appreciate your undoubted patience with my lack of being able to pronounce things. I only really speak English, and I am trying to get pronunciations correct, and I'm sorry that I know that I messed up. I hope it wasn't too grating on your ears. I did start a Discord for Detours in Archaeology. I hope you join so we can talk about stuff and what I should do next. I have a store on Printify. I'm also in the process of making a lot of different bone art, and I want to deal more with getting that out there to the public. If you have any comments, corrections, or questions, I encourage you to email me at detoursinarchaeology@gmail.com. You can comment directly on this podcast. You can go to my website at detoursinarchaeology.com and hit the contact button to contact me that way. Or you can follow me on any of my Blue Sky account or my Instagram. All the music comes from Scott Buckley, who can be found at scottbuckley.com.au. For the fun fact this week, at the time of this recording, tomorrow and the rest of this weekend will be UFO Fest here in Oregon. With that inspiration in mind, and with a bunch of just incredible natural chemistry, I have a fact that's a bit out of this world. The article I read was brought to my attention by my sister, who's visiting, and it's by David Bradley at the website Wiley Analytical Science. Astronomers studying the star-forming region Sagittarius B2 near the Milky Way center have detected 2 complex organic molecules in interstellar space. Ethanol formate, which gives raspberries their flavor and smells like rum, which just by itself sounds delicious, and N-propyl cyanide. Using the IRAM 30-meter radio telescope, they identified these molecules among thousands of spectral lines and use chemical models to show they likely form on dust grains as simple molecules in ice coatings, and that they're broken by UV light into the radioactive radicals that link them together. The findings suggest that even more complex organic molecules, potentially including amino acids like glycine, can form in space before planets even exist, meaning young planets could be seeded with prebiotic molecules early in their history. And that just pretty much blows my mind, because glycine is part of the building blocks of DNA. Radical. If you have any fun facts, don't be shy. Share them with me. I'd love to hear it. And I can salute you, metaphorically speaking. Just email me, and I'd love to share it with everyone else. Stay curious, stay inspired, and keep taking those detours. Thanks.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.